I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. A few generations ago, back in the 1950s, doctors made house calls and were not always truthful with their patients. It was the doctor knows best, and patients usually deferred to what he said, and it was mostly men back then. Physicians also had a limited repertoire of services they could offer. Fast forward to today, when new technologies have revolutionized healthcare, giving medical staff more tools to address problems when dealing with consumers who are more empowered through consent and through greater access to information. Interestingly, the public is less trusting of the healthcare system today, even though it can treat even cure conditions that used to be a death sentence. We also have the most expensive medical system in the world, one that exacerbates the divide between the healthcare haves and have-nots. Our guests Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno write about the ethical challenges posed by our healthcare system in their new book. It's called Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, but Nobody Wants to Die. Amy Gutman is the president of the University of Pennsylvania, a job she has had since 2004. She's also a professor of political science, and she's also former chair of President Obama's Bioethics Commission. And Amy Gutman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us, as I said, Jonathan Moreno. He's the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He was a senior advisor to President Obama's Bioethics Commission. And Jonathan Moreno, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you, Marty.
We have a lot to discuss, but let's begin with something personal and something even back in the 1950s. I'll start with you, Amy Gutman. You describe an experience with your grandmother who had diabetes. She was taken to the hospital. The doctors wanted to amputate her leg. What happened next?
So I was 10 years old, visiting my grandma with my mother. The doctor turned to my mother. My grandmother was fully conscious. She was in distress, but fully conscious. And the doctor asked my mom for permission to amputate her mother's leg. And my mother, being a very street-savvy woman, no college education, but boy, did she have smarts, she turned to the doctor and said, "You have to ask her permission, not mine." And my grandmother gave her permission. She survived the operation, died a few days later. And my mother told me much later in my life, she would never have forgiven herself had she not done that, had she not asked her own mom, my grandma Eva, for her permission. That was Doctor Knows Best medicine. And Jonathan and I actually bonded over telling each other our personal stories.
Well, in fact, Jonathan, a similar story, although this one involved your mother.
Right. When I was 6 years old, my mother was diagnosed with a chondrosarcoma, which was a cancer in the upper part of her arm, her shoulder. My father was a famous psychiatrist, but it still took them, with all his connections, a year to get an actual diagnosis at Memorial Hospital in New York. He was the one who had the responsibility for telling her her diagnosis. And then when she had her amputation, about 6 months later, she said that she was rifling through his files looking for something, and she found in a drawer crunched up in the back, because that's my father's file system.
I know those files. Right. Yes.
A letter to him from her surgeon, who she loved. She loved her surgeon. He saved her life, after all. Informing him, Dr. Moreno, that as we discussed, if your wife survives 5 years, you can consider her to be cured. That was not that prognosis conversation was not one that her surgeon had ever had with her. That was the way it was in 1958, particularly, I think, with female patients.
Well, and I'm assuming from these anecdotes, there are many other people similar age who can tell the same kind of story about withholding information, a doctor withholding information from a patient.
Absolutely. We've now shared the story as we are writing the book. It's in the book with many of our friends, including many younger friends who've had similar situations. Mm-hmm. It's changed over time. The culture has changed in that doctors and healthcare providers now know they must obtain the informed consent of patients, and almost all do. But the listening to patients is still a big challenge as grueling schedules have taken over clinical practices.
And if you look at the culture of the way that doctor-patient relations are described in the media, particularly television. We had a lot of fun with this.
Yeah, you did. Dr. Welby, Dr. Casey,
exactly,
Dr. Kildare.
Exactly, Dr. Kildare. They reflect the evolution of the TV doctor, the way the TV doctor is personified, is a reflection of the changing culture.
Well, Marcus Welby was portrayed by Robert Young of Doctors Knows Best fame.
Others Knows Best. Doctors Knows Best.
Then the most popular program in its second season on TV by Nielsen ratings. But then in later seasons, the Doctor Knows All Welby conflates homosexual with pedophilia. And even the sponsors then in the 70s started boycotting the show.
Interesting. And then I'm thinking, then we get to Nurse Jackie, and then the whole thing kind of falls apart. But are we talking about physicians lying to their patients, Jonathan Moreno?
Well, we have very good evidence that if patients didn't lie, they'll use a big word, obfuscate.
If doctors
didn't lie, they would obfuscate. Patients lied too. That's the other thing. In fact, our late friend and colleague, our late friend and colleague, Jay Katz, who I love to talk about, he died about 10 years ago. He wrote a lovely book called The Silent World of Doctor and Patient. He described the doctors giving orders and patients, and some of us still do this, as engaged in a guerrilla warfare with doctors for not taking our pills when we should or taking too many and so forth. That has probably opened up a bit in the last 30 years, but there's still some of that.
Well, I'm thinking of informed consent, which we certainly have now, Amy Guttman. But at the same time, I think as a patient myself, and I'm sure a lot of people feel this way, you go to see the doctor and you want to feel like, well, we're equals, we're together on this. But the experience isn't that way because you don't feel well, you're a patient, you didn't go to medical school. There is a kind of unevenness that seems built into this relationship.
Yeah. So we have to remember that doctors are experts in medicine, but they're not experts in us. And so we give ourselves and our readers three pieces of advice, which is come prepared, actually write down questions. Also be open about what you're doing. And finally, and probably most importantly, be clear about your goals. Tell your doctor or healthcare provider, and nurses are a very important part of this equation too. So tell them what you really want out of their advice and their prescriptions, because while we all are the same in that we're born and we age and we die, we all have different tolerances for pain, different personal goals in our life.
I'm wondering, though, and your book really looks at this transformation within our healthcare system. We begin in the 1950s, but here we are today. How much do you think, Jonathan, that just technology is sort of changing this doctor-patient relationship, changing things like consent, changing things like patient autonomy? How much is that really a driver?
It's a big driver. I think it's fair to say that the most prestige that physicians have ever had in history was in the 1950s, particularly in the West, because you had these penicillin, the magic bullet. You couldn't necessarily cure polio, but you could put kids in iron lungs and extend lives. But then in the early 1960s, you have episodes like thalidomide, this drug that was given to women, particularly in Western Europe and Scandinavia, for morning sickness, and turned out to be toxic to their fetuses. And I remember when I was about 10 years old, these photo spreads in magazines, Life magazine, had these pictures of these little babies who had no arms and legs.
Right. I remember.
And that made a big impression, right? When you're little, it really makes a big impression on you. And that was a shocking moment. And Americans started to realize that, well, medicine is great, but it also has a downside.
Well, and you also write about Tuskegee, which, of course, has had an extraordinary impact in creating a kind of mistrust of the system. This is withholding syphilis treatment to African Americans.
Absolutely. Absolutely scandalous. It was at a time also when American doctors and so on were looking at what was happening in Germany under Nazism and saying, they're the barbarians, this couldn't possibly happen here. And the exposés of Tuskegee, and then in my home city, Brooklyn, New York, there was a big expose too, something on a smaller scale but quite similar. This was a wake-up call for, and it was the beginning of bringing bioethics into the mainstream. And so now, if you fast forward, there are lots of new technologies. You asked about new technologies that are going on in which science is partnering with ethics. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, we're saving lives and also getting the informed consent of patients and also listening to what patients want in their own lives. And that's our goal, really, is to bring these conversations into the mainstream at a time when Americans care about healthcare more than they've ever cared about it before. And we think, rightly so, it is an essential enabler of everything else in our lives.
But it's so interesting. You go back to the 1950s, again, doctors making house calls. Not all of them did that, but it certainly did happen. There was this bond or this trusting relationship. There's so much mistrust of the system now, Jonathan Moreno, and it's such an interesting paradox because we can cure so many things now, treat so many things now, and yet there's so much suspicion.
Yeah, and it's part of the evidence I think we have that there's been a decrease in trust at institutions generally, the political system in particular, but even, you know, major educational institutions. And if you look at some of the recent data about this, expertise in general is not trusted anymore by many people. And that's really a big change. You know, when we were kids in the 1960s, again, think of the physicists and the people who put those guys on the moon. I mean, that was expertise writ large. It was so dramatic. And that has really fallen off in the last 30 or 40 years. And it has affected also the way people see the medical system, for sure.
And it's not all bad.
Right.
We have gone from a place, a culture of blind trust, those black bags were a mixed bag, to a place of earned trust. And trust ought to be earned. And that's why having a patient doctor, patient nurse, patient caregiver dialogue is a positive thing. It is true that trust in doctors has plummeted since the 1960s, from about over 70% to just over 30%. Wow. That's still on the high side with regard to other professionals and institutions, but we all have to earn the trust.
Well, and I think journalists are way at the bottom.
They're down at the bottom of the list.
Let me just reintroduce you. We're going to take a very short break. I do want to get our callers to join our conversation. Talking with Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno, they've got a new book, a brand new book. It's called Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die. That's actually from a blues song. It's subtitled Bioethics and the Transformation of Healthcare in America. Amy Gutman is the president of the University of Pennsylvania. Jonathan Moreno is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno. They both served on President Obama's Bioethics Commission. In fact, Amy Gutman headed it up, and we are talking about some of the ethical, bioethical issues related to our fast-moving, fast-changing healthcare system. Let's talk about the pill. Let's talk about a revolution, how that sort of opened the door to so many different things, including giving women, I'm looking at you, Amy Gutman, giving women control over their bodies and more control over their reproductive organs, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pill is one of those revolutionary new medicines. And it's made a huge difference in the ability of women to control their own destinies. And now, with new reproductive technologies, the complement to the pill, if you will, are methods like IVF, in vitro fertilization, surrogacy. So same-sex couples, single moms and dads, all can be parents, and responsible parents, loving parents, and medical technology has made this possible. So these are the choices that we talk about that simply did not exist. Some of them didn't exist in my childhood,
sure.
And there's still going to be more of them. They bring all kinds of legal challenges to them, but by and large, they result in new loving families that give freedoms to adults that they simply didn't have before. Freedoms not only to women, but same-sex couples as well.
And the other side of this coin, in not perfect ways, Jonathan Moreno, is abortion and the right to abortion. Roe v. Wade, something that you discuss in the book, talk about a hot-button issue.
Right. I mean, the advent of the pill did stimulate a backlash that we're still living with, including the continuing controversy about abortion rights, and with many people feeling that it was not wise, not a good thing for a society to have sex so technologically separated from reproduction. And then, again, going back to images from our childhood, seeing those first photographs of the fetus in the womb in major national magazines, now you begin to see the fetus as an independent entity. And what does that mean? And so we're still living through the implications, speaking of not only medical technology, but imaging technology as well, and the way that has created anxiety among people who are more traditionally oriented.
But is there a bioethical answer to the debate over abortion?
Well, we take the example of a couple, Dan Callahan and Sidney Callahan. Dan just died a few weeks ago. He was the founder of the first freestanding bioethics center, the first bioethics center, a former boss of mine, in fact, and his wife, Sidney. Dan was a pro-choice Catholic, and Sidney is a feminist who is believes that, you know, abortion is wrong. And they wrote a book about this called Understanding Differences, and they went on tour, this is 30 years ago, debating each other in a respectful way. And, you know, they're a model. So we don't offer a solution exactly in a moral sense, but, you know, there is a process that can be mm-hmm. respectful.
It's a rare conversation, I have to say. I mean, having talked about this issue, just a kind of a follow-up to this, though. But what we also see, so on the one hand, we've got all these reproductive technologies, and we also have states who are saying that we're going to deny abortion to a woman who has been raped.
Yeah, so part of the ongoing theme of our society and our book is how important it is to have people's voices heard and have Americans be able to take charge of their own destinies. And these states that are passing rape and incest prohibitions on, not on rape and incest, but on abortions under those conditions, the vast majority of Americans oppose those kinds of restrictions, whether they're pro-choice or pro-life. So you asked, is there a solution?
Mm-hmm.
No, there's not a solution, but there is a way in which we can take more charge of our own destinies in politics and hold politicians' feet to the fire when they try to do things that satisfy just a very tiny minority and the vast majority of very informed, caring Americans, ethical Americans, really oppose that. So that chipping away at Roe v. Wade is something that may actually bring more and more Americans' voices to be heard in our political system. And I think that's generally true in healthcare today.
What then is the role of bioethics in medicine? I mean, if you don't have all the answers for us.
Well, I like to think of bioethics, and we Amy, I've talked about this, as sort of an intensified version of kitchen table conversations that happen all the time. Gee, what do you think? My doctor thinks I ought to switch my drug, or my doctor thinks I ought to be part of this study. You know, I'm thinking about that. Or what about that whole new designer baby thing that I read about? What do you think about that? You think we should do that or not? So that's the way we think of bioethics, not only an academic conversation, which it is, but it's also has tracked and responded to the public conversations that have happened for the last 60 years.
Let me give you a local example that has huge worldwide consequences that really speaks to where bioethics is today. And that is what happens when science partners with ethics. So many people in Philadelphia have heard the story, but everybody should hear it if they haven't, of Emily Whitehead. She was a 7-year-old dying of ALL. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia. She had no regular treatments available to her. Her parents, Tom and Carrie, looked for any experimental treatment that might work, and there was one available at Children's Hospital, the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Carl June had discovered it. Now, and I tell my incoming students at Penn this story, when they were middle schoolers, Emily Whitehead was dying. She is now a healthy 14-year-old, cancer-free. And not only is she cancer-free, due to the advocacy of her parents and herself now, there are now thousands of children and adults who are in her situation who will have life because of this once experimental treatment. Now, there was a time when people couldn't trust medicine. But now they can trust these kinds of experimental treatments. And the big bioethical question is, who's going to have access to them? Are we going to make them affordable? And we think there's a way of doing that as long as we fund those treatments that do save lives and are effective and keep prices under control of those that don't have that kind of potential. It is a scandal in this country, by the way, that millions of people who suffer from diabetes and need insulin can't afford it. Mm. There's no other affluent society for which that is true. So we have to wrap our hands around the access and the affordability. And there are many ways of doing it, but they go together. As long as we have unaffordable medicine, we're going to have limited access. If we can get prices under control, we can also increase access.
Well, this, of course, gets us to a discussion about our health care system. I guess what's left of the Affordable Care Act, it seems like it's being sort of torn apart even as we speak. But there are, Jonathan Moreno, people talking about Medicare for all or some kind of universal health care to get everyone covered and to get everyone some kind of access to some kind of treatment.
The Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare, actually has brought millions and millions more people into the system that now have access to a doctor. And that really is a great accomplishment. And I think history will look back at it and say, you know, that was really a big step. We do have to fix some things. That's always true. It was true. We talk about Romney Care in Massachusetts, for example, that went through several years in which they had to go back and fix it. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of public policy. So there are some problems. There are junk insurance plans that young people are being allowed to buy in some states that will not help them if they really get sick. I know about this because I've had to talk to my daughter about this in California and warn her off some plans when she was between jobs in the entertainment industry. So there are co-pays, there are deductibles, there are things that we have to fix. But in general, we believe that the core proposition in the current health debate should be that we don't repeal without knowing what people think will replace it.
Well, you also say that health care is a right. I mean, it's only a right on paper if we don't have a system that provides it.
It's not enough to say healthcare is a right, but it is important to recognize that whatever philosophy one holds, there's a convergence in believing that in our lives, without essential healthcare, without basic healthcare, everything else is impossible. So we do say healthcare is a right, but we also say it's affordable, essential healthcare that's a right. We can't just live with the slogan, because we'll die with just the slogan. What we have to do, as Americans is take charge collectively of our fate and make sure that there's an option available to everybody that's affordable and that provides basic health care for everyone. And that's why we're in favor of a public option in addition to what's available now, a public option for anybody who wants it, and not taking away effective health care from anyone who has it now.
Well, and that's that collective thinking. I think when there's this sense of scarcity, the idea is, well, if you get something, then I'm, Jonathan, then I might lose out. We have to figure out whether there's some kind of an abundant way to think about our healthcare system.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a zero-sum game. Insurance is a classical system that enables us to pool our risks, right? And that was a brilliant insight in the late 19th century in England, and it turns out to be a really smart idea. Some German philosophers had that idea as well. So, you know, we all face risks. But we cannot all be expected, as the economists say, to internalize those risks. We have to pool the risks. Insurance is a really, really smart human idea.
A smart human idea, even though it sometimes doesn't feel that way.
The way it's implemented is always not always smart.
I hear you. I hear you. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We've got a lot of people that want to join us. That's Jonathan Moreno. He joins us along with Amy Gutman, and they have co-authored a new book called Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven and Nobody Wants to Die, Bioethics and the Transformation of Healthcare in America. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. Got a lot of them. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Abelino calling us from Reading. Abelino, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello, guys. Thank you very much for this topic today.
Sure.
I think it's really really interesting. So my story is that, you know, back in the springtime, I was a victim of a serious motorcycle crash. It crushed my leg. And so in the hospital, I was faced with, you know, the choice of trying to keep, you know, this non-tenable leg versus, getting an amputation, which I eventually elected for. And during that time, I was in the hospital for almost 2 months. I had like 19, 20 surgeries, and I was attended to by four different teams: orthopedic team, the trauma team, the immunologists, and also the internists, internal doctors. And all of that time, each team was attending me and meeting with me individually, and giving me these disparate pieces of advice that were almost contradictory. I'm fairly well educated. I'm a mechanical engineer, and,
sure,
and my wife is educated as well. And trying to digest all of that medical information, of which I'm a total layman, was just incredibly difficult. And eventually I got to the point where I got angry with the doctors, and I said, hey, why don't you guys just meet with me all together and let's discuss
there you go.
This. And yeah, and it's almost like, you know, I needed a project manager to help me manage all those different advices and give me the best, you know, recourse.
Sure. It's a really important story, and my guests look like they're about to jump through the microphone. Go ahead, Amy Gutman.
You came up with the solution that your doctor should have had in place, in structure. I have long advocated for collaborations across disciplines to solve any problem. In engineering, it's a classic example. There's no place where that's more important than in medicine. And so it is absolutely right what you said. Your doctors should come together. There ought to be a quarterback for every team. Mm-hmm. And that quarterback should be the person who is responsible for communicating with the patient what the team's recommendation is as a whole, if the team can't physically be present given the busyness. And that makes all the difference. It clearly would have made a difference to you. And you're also an example of why we have to take charge.
Sure.
We have to be well enough informed, as you were, to know that you needed an opinion that was a collective, not just hearing from everybody individually.
Abelino, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much. You wanted to add something?
Well, I just want to say, as the child of an amputee, you sound well. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And that's great. Yeah. And yes, as Amy says,
the,
there should be a primary care doctor coordinating. Many of the – when I used to do sort of bedside ethics, and many of the – what seemed to be ethical issues were really problems of communication. So often the role we would have as ethicists in the hospital would be to bring the teams together and get people to talk to each other.
And that is an ethical issue.
That is.
Communicating with patients is a prime ethical mandate.
Is that taught in medical schools?
Not enough, but it is now more than ever before.
Just because, I mean, it's
because patients' voices are now being heard, and patients are asking and in some cases demanding it, and it is something we're all do. We're all patients, and doctors of all people should recognize that. We also need, they have the hard problem of having screens in front of them where they have to enter data now and also not often being reimbursed for the time they spend talking to patients, which we also think is a very important detail of insurance that ought to come into the 21st century where it is part and parcel not only of what patients are owed, but by the way, it also produces better medical outcomes.
Well, and I was thinking, Jonathan, of a study, I can't conjure it up specifically, but when there is this more sort of healthy and interconnected doctor-patient relationship, there are less lawsuits.
There is evidence that there are fewer lawsuits if patients feel that they're being talked to openly. And part of that also is a matter of medical education. Now medical students are trained how to have the difficult conversation, quote unquote, which is not something that would happen 30 or 40 years ago in medical schools. You would see your assigned senior doctor, the attending doctor, have a difficult conversation, and then you would walk out and you'd think, well, I guess that's how you do it. Now it's much more systematic.
Yeah, they actually in the old days taught how not to have a difficult conversation.
Indeed.
And this is the difficult diagnosis, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Abelino, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking with Amy Gutman, Jonathan Moreno about their new book, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. I'm talking with Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno about bioethics and the transformation of healthcare in America, subtitled to their new book, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die. Let me get Steve from Villanova to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm not a tinfoil hat guy, even about the government's role in research, but and from this story, you'll understand why I do have somewhat of a mistrust. My brother had Down syndrome, was part of the generation that was deinstitutionalized back in the 70s. But before he was released to private homes, he was, and I got this later in a letter from the government, that said he was, without consent, obviously, exposed to radiation as part of a government-backed experiment in how radiation affects people, exposure to radiation. Said he may not have been exposed, but he was part of a population where some people were exposed. And this was, of course, 30 years. We were notified 30 years after the fact.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, you know, the invention of the IRBs that, you know, protect populations, particularly vulnerable populations. But it's impossible for me to forget how the government was complicit in research on vulnerable vulnerable population.
Absolutely. You know, I have to tell you, Steve, that Amy Gutman, both of our guests, myself included, we are all nodding our heads, I should say, in response to your comments. Should I toss that to you, Amy, or to you, Jonathan?
Well, Steve, I was a member of the senior staff of an advisory committee that President Clinton established in the mid-1990s. You might know about it. It was called the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments.
Oh.
And in that year and a half that we worked, we were able to declassify lots of documents that illustrated the history from the mid-40s through early 1970s of ionizing radiation experiments. So I know a lot of what you're talking about. Mm. And, you know, there's no excuse. But as you say, there is now an IRB system. It's much harder to get away with these things. And for what it's worth, also the Defense Department and the intelligence agencies have to abide by the same rules as the civilian agencies with respect to doing human experiments.
But as we heard from Steve, you know, he because of what was done to his brother, he does not trust the system. He says, I'm not a tinfoil guy,
right.
But I've got these questions.
Well, again, I think there is a healthy distrust of the system because the system ought to be more transparent, and it's become more transparent over time, but you ought to, given your experience of your family, it's every reason, and indeed I would say right, to demand that. And I, again, think we need to earn, the government needs to earn our trust. It ought not to be blindly trusted for the historical reasons you've given. And I think as a consequence, things like bigger protections for vulnerable populations have happened. Are we yet in heaven? No, hence the title of our book. We really want, we're in a very imperfect system, but it's the voices of people like you, when they're heard, that make the system better.
Steve, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss something else that you write about in the book, which is the right to die. And you even say that the case, it's a really moving and complicated case, a young woman named Brittany Maynard, who got a difficult diagnosis and decided that she was going to take things into her own hands.
Brittany Maynard was 29 years old. She was a most admirable young woman who had done service abroad for vulnerable populations. She had not only a difficult but one of the worst diagnoses of a totally incurable brain cancer, and she had many surgeries, and she was on her last 6 months, and she decided she wanted to, in her own terms, die with dignity and die with her husband at her side. They were just married for 2 years. Die in a way that she felt she'd still be herself. The prognosis was of morphine-induced treatments while they would ease her pain, they would change her personality. So she not only moved from California to Oregon, which at the time was the only place that had physician-assisted death, but she became a champion for a movement. And almost single-handedly, because of her words, saying, I would want anyone who walked a mile in my shoes to have the same choice that I had, she helped bring about legislation in California. Now, most recently, New Jersey has passed legislation. The vast majority of Americans approve of this. We have very strong guardrails, so there isn't, and as we write in the book, there is not any evidence in this country of a slippery slope. And so it's a very important choice for a small number of people who face this horrible end-of-life situation, which most Americans want to have that choice. Actually, most doctors say that they want to have the choice, even though the organized medical community has opposed this. What we can all converge on, I think it's really important, is that a lot of people don't know about hospice care, and there isn't as much controversy over it. And again, it needs to be made more accessible. But we also think that Brittany Maynard made a very compelling case, and it's not surprising to us that a majority of Americans are in favor of it.
We don't use, as I understand, physician-assisted suicide? I mean, we've sort of decoupled that, have we not, Jonathan?
You know, I think the word suicide is kind of a red herring. The real question is how do people, you know, want to die, and what are the guardrails, as Amy put it, that society places around that? The bigger story here is part of the, you know, the big theme of the book, which is the shifting control between doctors and patients over, in this case, powerful medication. But as Amy says, the problem of access to hospice is really a serious one. About 6 months ago, one of our friends died. He was a psychiatrist, and again, somebody who, you know, went to a fancy medical school and had a practice in Washington, and it's incredible what they went through to get him into hospice. It just shouldn't be that way. So, you know, some of these are human systems that are admit of human solutions. We do need to focus on them.
I've been with family members as they have died or are in the process of dying. And sometimes I just say, as a sort of outside observer who loves this person who's in this bed, sometimes you don't know, are they dying? Are they living? Are we near the end? Are we in the middle? Is this curable? Do we do one more procedure because the surgeon thinks, oh, if we just did one more little thing, I think we can bring this person around. It's just such a difficult, and even for, I think, people that are committed to this person, it's just so hard, Amy, to know what to do.
It is hard to know what to do, and I've faced this situation over and over again in my life. I've had, alas, many too many deaths of loved ones. And what it's compelled me to do is actually inform myself more and take on the cause with Jonathan of encouraging everybody to become more informed about what's available, what we think should be available, both to be better advocates in our own lives and also better advocates collectively for what should be available to every single member of our society, no matter what their wealth or lack thereof is.
And to be able to make this decision for yourself without others intervening?
A very wise cancer social worker said to me, it's got to be 30 or 40 years ago, you know, people tend to die the way they lived. Huh. People who had a lot of friends and family around them were very sociable. They want them around. People who are a little more isolated and only chose a couple of intimates to be there, that's kind of what they decide. People who want to give it over to the experts or people who really want to be in control of the options. So, you know, you're in many ways, depending on the course of your dying, who you are and really your values really come through in that period.
Destigmatizing those discussions and having them early on before you face an urgent situation is so important. It's very hard to take some time off in any day, regardless of what you're doing, whether you're watching your favorite sitcom or at work, to actually sit down with a loved one and say, this is what I think I'd like at the end of my life. Can we talk about this? And those discussions were absolutely stigmatized in the old days, and we're having them more now, but not enough, still not enough.
Here's an email from Stephen. He says, in your New York Times piece, you wondered why dialysis was carved out for payment by Medicare. My father was a lawyer for Medicare. He told me that at the time there was a shortage of dialysis beds because it was expensive to provide, and the government wanted to make the treatment more widely available. Nobody foresaw that dialysis would become an opportunity for private companies to make a buck, because at the time all dialysis was provided by nonprofit medical centers. You're nodding your head, John.
Right. I remember the period very well, and you know, who even now thinks that people who have end-stage renal disease shouldn't have access to dialysis? But it has unintended consequences, as Stephen says. It's kind of put a block on progress in care for people with end-stage renal disease. We're still doing what we did 40 years ago. And also, the system now needs to be adapted so that home dialysis may be an option for some people. People would prefer, in general, to be at home. And of course, now we have interventions for lots of diseases that are life-threatening. But we've got this funny imbalance where we have this special markout for end-stage renal disease as compared to so many other diseases. It doesn't make any sense anymore. We have to make some adjustments here.
Here's an email from Cynthia. She says, I work for a large orthopedic hospital in Pennsylvania, and there's so much competition between hospitals now. Doctors want to deliver the best care and score well with Prescani, I don't know what that is. In an effort to satisfy patients, especially those suffering with pain, prescription opioids are overly dispensed to appease them. They keep coming back. Definitely a question of ethics.
Definitely a question of ethics. And there's a good way of thinking about this, which goes back to the eminent philosophers, the Rolling Stones. You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you can get what you need. We think it's possible, and we've seen societies where this has happened. Affluent societies like ours, which spend less on medicine but have much better outcomes and have universal care, that the things that people need, like insulin, like renal dialysis, like transplants, they get. But the things that they may want at the time, which are opioids, for example, and they don't need, in fact, are counterproductive, they don't get. We have opened the floodgates on opioids in this country and not enabled access to things like insulin, inhalers for asthma. This is a topsy-turvy world in this regard, where we're spending twice as much as any other society. So I think the issue of opioids and bringing them under control is something that has just come on the radar screen. I know at the University of Pennsylvania at our hospitals, we have some experts who are really working on this, and responsible doctors don't prescribe opioids as a first line of defense against pain.
Let me toss something else out that you write about in the book, Jonathan. This is nudging, which is, trying to influence patients to make the right decision for themselves.
We were just talking before the show about our favorite breakfast cereals.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, those.
We were nudged to have things like Cocoa Crisps.
Right.
Cocoa Krispies, and then it became Cookie Crisps, yeah. Which my mother said, you might as well just eat my chocolate chip cookies for breakfast,
course.
Right?
Yeah. Of course.
We were nudged in supermarkets all the time, to candies, to sugar-loaded candies.
Exactly, by corporate interests. And then some years ago, parents started saying, you know, at the checkout counter, I'd really like to have some options, which don't involve, you know, some healthy options that don't involve those candies, because I know my son or my daughter is going to go nuts when we get to the checkout counter, and I don't want that. So the thing about nudging, the idea is that we can participate as consumers in how we want to be nudged. Not that corporate interests decide for us, but we can decide. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think has happened. At the checkout counter, you have the option of not going past the Snickers bars with your three-year-old.
But isn't it about compliance? I mean, to sort of create conditions so that someone will take their medication.
Yeah, so on the medication side and on things that we all have as goals, whether if we're smokers, to end smoking, if we're overweight, to bring down our weight, in my case, to eat less sugar. I really was successfully nudged, or in my culture we would have called it nudged, to
right.
eat candy with sugar. It was all over. There are ways of doing that give us choices that incline us, that predispose us to the healthy choice. In schools, cafeterias, it's putting healthy foods up front. In the case of cessation of bad habits, it's actually give people payment ahead of time, and then they have to pay it back if they don't reach their goal. They may not like that, so you could give them the choice of getting paid only if you succeed. It's an interesting question. We won't give you the answer
right.
to it, but which works better? Does upfront payment where you have to give back, or back payment work better? Either one's a nudge, but there are good experiments now on which nudges work better. Our point is that we should actually have some say in how we're nudged.
Agreed?
Yeah, although I still like my Frosted Flakes.
I did not know that. Well, we are going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for coming in. Jonathan Moreno, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Amy Gutman as well. And again, they have co-authored a new book called Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die. You can catch up with them. They're going to be at the Free Library of Philadelphia Monday evening on September 16th. I should add that Amy Gutman is the president of the University of Pennsylvania, also former chair of President Obama's Bioethics Committee. And Jonathan Moreno served as a senior advisor on that commission. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls.